Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, August 21st issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our first article today, Woman Arrested in Plot to Bomb New York State Capitol. Federal prosecutors say the woman met with an FBI informant several times to plan an attack on the building, which houses the governor's office. By Benjamin Oreskes and William K. Rashbaum. Federal agents and police detectives have arrested a 35-year-old woman who prosecutors say was planning to bomb the New York State Capitol, according to a criminal complaint filed in federal court on Thursday. The woman, Jessica Bowie, was charged with one count of attempting to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization, according to the complaint. In the complaint, Joshua Parker, a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Albany, detailed how agents used Ms. Bowie's social media posts to identify her as a potential threat and mounted a sting operation to arrest her. Ms. Bowie told an FBI informant that she had been contemplating an attack more seriously in the past 4 to 6 months, according to the complaint. She also posted messages of support on social media, including one praising the September 11th attacks on New York and the Pentagon. In mid-July, an FBI informant pretending to be a facilitator began talking with Ms. Bowie about her plans to attack the New York State Capitol building in Albany, according to the complaint. Ms. Bowie told this informant she lived near the Capitol and wanted to help building a bomb. According to messages that were included in the complaint, Ms. Bowie wrote to the informant that she wanted to target the New York State Capitol, ideally in a way I could get away with and hop on a plane after. But I don't know if it's doable, she wrote. Ms. Bowie appeared in federal district court in Albany on Thursday afternoon and was detained by a federal magistrate judge, Daniel J. Stewart, pending a detention hearing. She is being represented by the Office of the Federal Public Defender, Eric K. Schillinger, who said the office does not comment on active cases. Governor Kathy Hochul said in a written statement that there was no immediate threat at this time and her administration had taken steps to increase security around the Capitol and other government buildings amid a rise in political violence and threats against public officials. I'm grateful to the FBI for leading this investigation and to the New York State Police for their work to apprehend this dangerous individual, she added. The complaint, which was filed in federal district court in Albany, describes an audio message that Mr. Parker claims is Ms. Bowie pledging her allegiance to the Islamic State. Over the last month, Ms. Bowie scouted the building, which includes Ms. Hochul's office, at least 5 times. The complaint includes images from security cameras that show someone taking photos of the Capitol building and its surrounding complex. On August 5th, Ms. Bowie met with 2 other informants who explained to her what materials she would need to make a bomb, according to the complaint. The complaint then says that one of the informants gave her $200. And later that day, Ms. Bowie went to a nearby Home Depot and bought a bin full of nails, among other things. She told these informants that she wanted to try to get a good enough explosive in there to kill the senators and ideally to destroy as much of the building as possible, according to a transcript of a recorded conversation included in the complaint. Last week, Ms. Bowie asked these informants for help buying a gun, according to the complaint. On Wednesday, they met her in a car to explain how to operate and detonate the bomb she was planning to build. When she exited the vehicle, FBI agents arrested her. The complaint states that Ms. Bowie told agents in an interview, "There's no helping me. You guys know enough." She added that she had found on Google that she faced as many as 20 years in prison if she was convicted of what she was accused of doing, the complaint said. My office looks forward to aggressively prosecuting this case and delivering justice for the American people, John A. Sarcone III, the first assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of New York, said in a statement. Hochul's advice for Mamdani: focus on New York City. In a wide-ranging interview, Governor Kathy Hochul stressed the values she shares with Mayor Zohran Mamdani and talked about President Trump, taxes, and ICE. By Grace Ashford. Governor Kathy Hochul had some rare public advice for Zohran Mamdani, the mayor, whose whirlwind ascent and audacious approach to messaging have made him a global figure. Pay attention to New York, not Israel. In a wide-ranging interview with New York Times, Hochul was asked about Mr. Mamdani's call last month for the federal government to arrest Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whom he called a war criminal. His rhetoric drew international attention and some condemnation, with Mr. Netanyahu accusing the mayor of fomenting hate, an allegation some Jewish leaders echoed as the city confronts a rise in anti-Semitic attacks. Ms. Hochul, on the eve of the fifth anniversary of her swearing in, tiptoed around the differences between herself, a fierce supporter of Israel, and Mr. Mamdani, a fierce critic. But when asked whether Mr. Mamdani's approach might worsen the uneasiness felt by many Jewish New Yorkers, she offered frank, if gentle, guidance. I encourage him to, let's focus on the blocking and tackling of city government, the governor said, noting the two leaders shared emphasis on expanding childcare, improving bus speeds, and building housing. That is where I believe the main focus should be. In the 40-minute interview, Ms. Hochul, who faces the Republican Bruce Blakeman in her re-election bid in November, outlined her views on a range of topics but sidestepped many others. Her remarks also provided telling insight into the partnership that Ms. Hochul, 67, has built with Mr. Mamdani, 34, and the divisions that remain between them. The governor said that she had no intention of raising taxes or implementing new ones in the coming year, but indicated that could change if there were additional unforeseen cuts in federal aid to New York. This year, facing deep cuts in such aid and a city budget deficit, Ms. Hochul did approve a new tax on high-end second homes in New York City, allowing Mr. Mamdani to deliver, at least in part, on his campaign promise to tax the rich. She declined to take a position on whether Amazon should hire employees rather than third-party contractors to make deliveries, as unions, city council members, and Mr. Mamdani have demanded. And while Ms. Hochul, a self-described Biden Democrat, has at times seemed dismissive of the insurgent leftist movement led by Democratic socialists like Mr. Mamdani, on Wednesday, she said the movement's goals were in line with core Democratic values like expanding health care and education. We take care of people. That's the FDR, JFK, Bill Clinton, Obama, Biden wing of the party, and that has not changed, Ms. Hochul said. She rejected the premise that socialist victories in primaries across the nation were a threat to the party, saying she welcomed the energy they represented, particularly from young people. The comments marked a difference between Ms. Hochul and the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, a fellow New Yorker, who, during an appearance on Meet the Press this month, distanced himself from the DSA agenda. Even so, there is no shortage of deep disagreements between the moderate Ms. Hochul and Mr. Mamdani, and few are as thorny as their stances on Israel and its war in Gaza. In the aftermath of the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7, 2023, Ms. Hochul argued for the nation's right to defend itself, even implying that it would be justified in destroying Gaza. She later apologized. She has been more willing of late to criticize Israel, however, calling reports of starvation among Palestinians unconscionable. On Wednesday, the governor repeatedly steered the conversation back to New York and her administration's efforts to protect all marginalized communities. But she reaffirmed her commitment to the safety of Jewish New Yorkers. I will throw my body against any anti-Semitism, she said. I have and I will. Despite their differences, Mr. Mamdani has sought to find common ground with the governor, complimenting her pragmatic but unflinching relationship with President Trump and her efforts to restrict the operations of federal immigration agents. He has zealously backed her re-election. In the interview, Ms. Hochul also emphasized her concerns about the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, suggesting that federal agents' presence might intimidate voters in November. They're going to be at polling places, she said, and it's very threatening for black and brown citizens. While she has been forceful in her public criticism, Ms. Hochul said she has also employed more diplomatic tactics, pressing the president, thus far unsuccessfully, for an extension of temporary protected status for Haitian and Salvadoran immigrants who fled violence. In a recent phone conversation with Mr. Trump, I said, "I need them. They're hardworking. They're part of our community," Ms. Hochul said of the immigrants, many of whom work as home health aides. "We're going to have a health care crisis of epic proportions when people don't show up the next day for grandma and grandpa," she recalled saying. What was Mr. Trump's response? "I'll look into it," Ms. Hochul said with a sigh. Walmart posts slowest sales growth in years as Americans tighten wallets. Walmart and other big U.S. retailers have warned that consumers were being cautious, even if household balance sheets seemed healthy. By Kim Bassin. Walmart posted the slowest sales in years in its home market of the United States as consumers worried about their finances tightened their wallets. Comparable sales at Walmart's U.S. stores rose 2.6% in its most recent quarter, the retailer reported on Thursday, its slowest growth in more than 6 years. The company's stock fell more than 9%, erasing tens of billions of dollars in market value in its steepest daily decline since 2002. The world's largest retailer has been on a roll, with cost-conscious shoppers flocking to its stores in search of deals in an uncertain economy. Walmart said that lower drug prices brought on by regulatory changes dragged down its U.S. sales last quarter. Still, the company raised its outlook for sales and profit for the full fiscal year. Company executives said the business saw shoppers' behavior change when the national average price of gasoline surpassed $4 per gallon in July, an indication that American consumers were feeling more pressure than they did at the beginning of the year. "Perhaps there's a psychological impact to that," John David Rainey, the chief financial officer of Walmart, said on a conference call with investors and analysts. America's biggest retailers said this week that consumers had been wary with their spending and keen to get value from every dollar spent, even if household balance sheets seemed healthy. Reported earnings this week from Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, and TJX, the parent company of TJ Maxx, provided a snapshot of how American households are faring as the cost of living remains high, including grocery bills, housing costs, and gas prices. At the same time, the job market has remained fragile and wage growth has slowed. Delinquencies on credit cards, auto loans, and student debt are on the rise. Households' balance sheets remain healthy in aggregate, but the saving rate is very low, and elevated loan delinquencies suggest that a significant minority are struggling to make ends meet. Samuel Toombs and Oliver Allen, economists at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said in a note. Shoppers also pulled back on spending at the start of the second half of the year, with retail sales down 0.6% in July from the prior month, according to nationwide data released by the Census Bureau. But with back-to-school season kicking off, and as retailers prepare for the impending holiday rush, the companies are hoping that shoppers become less stingy. Retailers have tried to keep prices down. Some have cited tariff refunds, the repayments to businesses after the Supreme Court's ruling in February that struck down many of the Trump administration's emergency import taxes, as giving them leeway to keep prices down. Target said that it had lowered prices on about 10,000 items in its stores over the past year, and that it would push for more price reductions. Almost its entire selection of school supplies is priced at or below what they were last year. "We're proud of that price investment," Michael Fedelka, the chief executive of Target, told investors. "We think it matters to consumers right now." Walmart has been reducing prices too, and the retailer has told investors that it has made it a priority to use its tariff refund on price cuts. In the United States, Walmart temporarily lowered the prices of 11,000 items last quarter, up from 7,200 in the previous quarter, and intends to make those reductions permanent when possible. TJX, the owner of the off-price chains TJ Maxx and Marshalls, said that its selection of cheap goods had put it in a good position to capitalize on economic trends, and that it saw higher customer traffic and a rise in what shoppers spent per visit. Comparable sales rose 4% in its most recent quarter, and company executives are plowing ahead with plans to add hundreds of new stores. Home improvement stores have been struggling for several years. Households worried about their finances amid economic uncertainty and high mortgage rates have put off big-ticket renovations. Housing turnover has also been low. There's just no sign of an inflection point at this moment, Richard McPhail, the chief financial officer at Home Depot, told investors. Marvin Ellison, the chief executive of Lowe's, said high interest rates, inflation, and the price of gas had weighed on his customer base, which is made up of middle-income homeowners. "It's a combination of fuel prices, geopolitical events, and other uncertain things," Mr. Ellison said. "People are just being cautious with their discretionary spend." Resilient consumer spending in the first half of 2026 was fueled by a robust tax refund season, said John Mercer of CoreSite Research, a research and advisory firm. "The question as we head later in the year is, what happens when those tax refunds start to deplete and diminish?" Mr. Mercer said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Treasury turns to interventionist tactics to lower interest rates. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is reinventing the government's role in the world's most important bond market, by Alan Rappaport and Colby Smith. The Trump administration's Treasury Department has become increasingly interventionist in its efforts to bend the forces of global markets to lower the cost of living in the United States, but it is finding that success does not come easily. The assertiveness comes as the U.S. gross national debt topped $40 trillion on Wednesday, a milestone driven largely by growing interest payments to investors who hold government debt. High interest rates and elevated prices have combined to sour the views of voters on President Trump's handling of the economy. This week, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent made a surprising move to calm the jittery bond market. He announced that the Treasury Department would be doubling the amount of government debt it is permitted to buy back from investors. The increase was intended to limit the rise of long-term government bond yields as a way to contain borrowing costs. "Part of this is signaling and to show that we believe that yields don't reflect the underlying fundamentals," Mr. Bessent said in an interview with CNBC on Thursday. Explaining that he is willing to expand the buyback program, Mr. Bessent argued that investors are misreading the market. "We are trying to keep the market in equilibrium," Mr. Bessent added. "Those yields, which represent what investors are demanding to be paid in order to buy bonds, spiked to their highest levels since 2007. The yields, which move inversely to bond prices, dipped after Mr. Bessent's announcement on Wednesday. By Thursday, yields were rising again, underscoring the challenge of such interventions, given the fundamental issues that are making bond investors jittery. Mr. Bessent has been trying other approaches to push down borrowing costs. The Treasury Department has been issuing more short-term bills that mature in less than a year to help keep interest rates lower. The strategy is similar to one that was used by Mr. Bessent's predecessor, Janet L. Yellen. In 2024, Mr. Bessent criticized Ms. Yellen for deploying that approach, saying she was using the Treasury Department to loosen financial conditions in the economy before the presidential election. This is not Mr. Bessent's first intervention. This month, he made a rare intervention in currency markets to prop up the weakening yen. The purchases of the Japanese currency were intended to help Japan avoid selling its holdings of U.S. treasuries to boost the yen's value. Such a move would have further flooded the market with treasuries, which would have pushed up yields as supplies overwhelmed demand. "I think it's both economic and political," said Nellie Lang, who served as Undersecretary for Domestic Finance at the Treasury Department in the Biden administration. "They think these higher rates are a problem." Ms. Lang noted that the Biden administration introduced the bond buyback program and said that she was surprised that Mr. Bessent made the announcement without a formal process. Treasury, which has long maintained a strategy of making regular and predictable announcements for these kinds of policy changes, held its quarterly refunding, where it usually announces debt issuance plans, in early August, but made no mention of larger bond buybacks. In the wake of Wednesday's move, investors have been left wondering what comes next as yields continue to push higher. Part of Mr. Bessent's problem, according to Sophia Drossos, an economist at Point72, a hedge fund, is that not all of the drivers of the rise in long-end yields are under direct control of the Treasury. Treasury yields have risen because of a combination of factors. The U.S. fiscal situation appears to be getting only worse, not better. Inflation concerns continue to linger amid the continuing war with Iran and skepticism about whether Kevin M. Warsh, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, will follow through with interest rate increases if inflation does not continue easing. An influx of new debt issued by technology companies to fund the artificial intelligence build-out has also entered the bond market. The Treasury Department, in announcing Wednesday's move, kept open the possibility that the Treasury would upsize its interventions as necessary, suggesting that buybacks could become a more active tool if markets become disorderly. At a certain point, large enough buybacks could have a lasting impact by fundamentally changing the amount of supply available for buyers. Thomas Simmons, chief U.S. economist at Jefferies, estimates that buybacks in the vicinity of $6 to $8 billion would have that effect, but would represent a significant escalation in the Treasury's involvement. The uncertainty factor linked with holding longer-term securities over shorter-term ones, known as the term premium, would likely fall, Mr. Simmons said, translating to lower inflation-adjusted yields on a sustained basis. How the Fed sets policy from here will also play a part in determining whether there is another leg higher in the longer-term yields that necessitates further interventions from the Treasury. Officials at the Fed are actively debating whether they need to raise interest rates at their next meeting in mid-September. The decision hinges in large part on the trajectory of inflation after two relatively benign reports that showed price pressures modestly improving since June. Another month of moderate data would help to ease some of the urgency around raising rates, but it would not entirely eliminate the possibility of doing so later this year. Many officials have already backed a rate increase, having grown impatient by the fact that inflation has overshot the Fed's 2% target for roughly half a decade. Any indication that progress toward that goal is once again stalling is likely to compel others to join this cohort. Mr. Warsh is also likely to pursue policies that reduce the Fed's $6.8 trillion portfolio of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities, having called for a leaner, meaner balance sheet at a congressional hearing last month. A smaller balance sheet, depending on how it is pursued, could put the Fed at cross purposes with the Treasury, said Blake Gwynn, head of U.S. rates strategy at RBC Capital Markets. You've got Bessent, who obviously would prefer not to have long-end yields going up, and then you've got Warsh now suggesting that he's going to tighten policy by pushing long-end yields up through balance sheet action. Mr. Warsh has called for more coordination between the Treasury and the Fed, however, suggesting that the central bank chairman will not proceed unilaterally. One potential opportunity could arise if the Fed shifts the composition of its balance sheet such that it is holding more short-term securities rather than longer-term ones over time. That would correspond with Mr. Bessent's penchant for issuing Treasury bills, which mature in 1 year or less. In the wake of Mr. Bessent's buyback announcement, investors are already preparing for the possibility that he cuts back on the amount of longer-term debt to be issued going forward. Upon taking office last year, Mr. Bessent acknowledged that elevated yields, particularly for the 10-year bond, were among his biggest concerns. He said in an interview with Tucker Carlson that he viewed himself as the United States' leading bond salesman, noting how the rate on that bond tracks closely with mortgage rates. We've got a tremendous amount of debt to roll. Several big brokerages leave customer accounts open to theft, senators say. Senators Ron Wyden and Elizabeth Warren, ranking Democrats on the Finance and Banking Committees, have urged regulators to require brokerages to provide stronger consumer protections. By Tara Siegel Bernard. It's a crime that usually happens quickly. Thieves use stolen information to open a brokerage account in your name. Soon after, your savings are siphoned from your real brokerage account into the fraudulent one. Then the thieves vanish with your money. Regulators have warned brokerages in recent years that this type of crime has been on the rise, but they haven't required financial firms to adopt the strongest preventative measures, only suggesting that companies provide them. That has left many brokerage customers potentially vulnerable, depending on where they do business and what safeguards are offered. Some large institutions, including Citi and Charles Schwab, do not allow customers to lock their brokerage accounts to protect themselves from these types of unauthorized transfers. And some, including Wells Fargo and Citi, do not alert customers when their money is redirected into another account, according to a recent analysis of a dozen major brokerage firms by Senators Ron Wyden and Elizabeth Warren, ranking Democrats on the Finance and Banking Committees. The lawmakers are urging regulators to require stricter measures. The review followed a New York Times article from last fall that shed light on the fraud, which is named after the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service, or ACATS, the behind-the-scenes plumbing system that financial institutions use to move customers' assets, like stocks and bonds, from one bank or brokerage to another. Bad actors are increasingly exploiting structural weaknesses in the ACATS system to illicitly drain customers' brokerage accounts, including retirement funds, the senators wrote in a letter to Robert W. Cook, chief executive of FINRA, the financial industry's self-regulatory organization. A recent review of major brokerage firms conducted by our offices reveals a deeply concerning lack of standardized, customer-controlled protections across the industry. The lawmakers called on FINRA to immediately create rules that would require financial firms to notify customers of any outgoing transfers and to let customers lock their accounts until firms came up with a process that would require customers to approve such transfer requests. In October, The Times reported on a case in which a Vanguard customer discovered that holdings in his wife's Roth individual retirement account had vanished. An online criminal had opened two accounts in her name at Merrill Edge, another brokerage platform, and requested the transfer from Vanguard. The couple was lucky. The fraudster hadn't yet run off with the money, so Merrill was able to freeze the account. The ease with which fraudsters can open accounts, often using stolen data or a combination of stolen and false information, like an email address or a mobile phone number, makes it easier to perpetuate the heist. But to pull it off, criminals need to know the other account's details. Fidelity and Vanguard offer self-directed features that let customers block these transfers. According to the senator's letter, JPMorgan Chase, Robinhood, Webull, and Wells Fargo all said they offer similar account locks, but they can be enabled or disabled only by customer service. E-Trade and Morgan Stanley Wealth Management recently added that capability after the inquiry. Customers at Merrill Edge, part of Bank of America, can put a restriction on their account by calling customer service, a spokeswoman said on Thursday. Robinhood told lawmakers that it would install a user-managed locking feature by the end of March, the letter said. Webull said on Wednesday that it had recently enabled the feature ahead of its agreed deadline, and Interactive Brokers confirmed it would add a customer-managed ACATS locking feature by the end of September. Once a brokerage customer, or in this case an imposter, requests a transfer through the institution receiving the money, the firm that is holding the funds has a day to validate that the assets are available for transfer and that the customer's identifying information is accurate. Within 3 days, it must make the transfer. The legislators have also requested that FINRA strengthen the ACATS transfer process by requiring the account holder, from where the money is being withdrawn, to confirm the transaction in an authenticated session on the outgoing broker's website or mobile app. Many firms at least alert customers that a transfer has been requested. Additionally, the senators urged the regulator to require brokerages to secure customer accounts with a newer technology called passkeys, which they said were stronger than traditional multi-factor authentication, such as verification codes sent by email or text that fraudsters can easily bypass. FINRA declined to comment on the letter, but said it was among the first regulators to identify this misconduct and alert its member firms. "We are actively engaged with the wider securities industry," FINRA said in a statement, "to determine what further actions are necessary to protect investors." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Weary USS Abraham Lincoln leaves Middle East. The aircraft carrier has been deployed for 9 months, largely in support of U.S. operations against Iran, and is now heading home to San Diego, by John Ismay. The beleaguered aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln's work in the Middle East is complete, and the ship, along with its crew of about 5,000 sailors, began its journey home to San Diego on Thursday, after 9 months of deployment. Another carrier, the Japan-based George Washington, has taken the Lincoln's place. A U.S. official confirmed the Lincoln's departure, which was alluded to by Admiral Brad Cooper, who heads U.S. Central Command, in an opinion essay about the Abraham Lincoln published in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday. "Godspeed and enjoy the well-deserved reunion soon," the admiral wrote. The Abraham Lincoln has been deployed in the Middle East as part of American operations against Iran. Reports began surfacing in recent weeks about poor quality of life aboard the ship because of logistics challenges brought about by Iran's destruction of a Navy base in Manama, Bahrain, that served as a vital supply hub. The Abraham Lincoln departed San Diego on November 21st of last year and has spent the entirety of those 272 days at sea, save for a brief stop in Guam in December and one in Oman to take on supplies. Thousands of sailors aboard the ship have not had any days off to rest and now have a roughly 13,000-mile voyage home, which could take 4 to 5 weeks. Democratic lawmakers have cited reports of shortages of basic supplies, water contamination, plumbing issues, and deteriorating mental health aboard the carrier. Admiral Cooper called many of those issues old news in his opinion essay. In a social media post on Sunday, Central Command, which directs military operations in the region, wished the Lincoln fair winds and following seas, a traditional Navy farewell that references the age of sail. On Thursday, another post said the USS George Washington had arrived in the Middle East and begun operating under Central Command's control on Wednesday. The Navy is maintaining about 20 warships in the Middle East outside of the Persian Gulf. Two carrier strike groups centered around the USS George H.W. Bush and the George Washington, one amphibious ready carry group carrying a Marine Expeditionary Unit, and several destroyers that are enforcing President Trump's renewed blockade of Iranian ports, which has entered its 38th day. Bare grocery shelves are a new wartime hardship for Ukrainians. After years of pounding power plants in cities, Russia's air war has taken aim at Ukraine's supermarket warehouses. By Kim Barker and Alexandra Mikolishin. There was no disguising the gaps in the usually well-stocked shelves of a Silpo supermarket in Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital, this week. They had no barley, buckwheat, quinoa, or rice, no spring onions or packaged lettuce, just one lonely, wilted bunch of cilantro. For the first time since the initial months after the 2022 invasion, the city's residents are experiencing shortages of a wide range of grocery staples because of Russian ballistic missile strikes on critical distribution centers. "It's a nightmare," said a Silpo shopper, Nina Kirichuk, 67, a retired hairdresser, her cart carrying bread and two kinds of herring. "I'm horrified. I want to buy sugar, but I looked and there wasn't any. And there's an entire section over there that's completely empty. I didn't even go in there. I don't want to look at it and upset myself." Moscow's missiles struck at least four warehouses for one supermarket supply company on August 5th, killing at least 6 workers and severely disrupting the supply of food to multiple store chains. The effects have been felt mainly in the capital, but also in far-flung places like Zaporizhia in southeastern Ukraine. Early Thursday, Russia again targeted food warehouses near Kyiv, although the extent of the damage from the missile strikes was not yet clear. Missiles have also destroyed a warehouse for another supermarket chain, a distribution center for Rosetka, an online shopping site, and a sorting center for Ukraine's National Postal Service. Warehouses of major Ukrainian book publishers have been repeatedly hit this summer. The attacks have come as the air war has intensified, with Ukraine building up its offensive capabilities and Russia taking advantage of Ukraine's dwindling air defenses. In the first few years after Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022, the Kremlin asserted that it hit only military-related targets in Ukraine, even as it pummeled cities and the power grid. Now it has dropped that pretense. Ukraine still maintains that it avoids civilian targets, though it has deployed its long-range drones against Russia's oil industry, the engine of the Russian economy. Recently, it has also hit warehouses of Wildberries, Russia's version of Amazon, claiming many of its products have military applications. For years, fully stocked Ukrainian supermarkets have been a symbol of how the country has done its best to preserve normal life through Russian bombardment. But over the past week, grocery chains admitted shortages. Supplies of dairy products, meat, and fresh produce have dwindled. At a corner shop in Kyiv, the only produce remaining were 6 mushy avocados and the papery skins of a few onions and garlic bulbs. Specialty items like ramen had disappeared from another store, along with paper plates and plastic cutlery. Am I the only one these empty shelves are starting to make panic? An aspiring beauty influencer posted on social media, adding that she had bought the last 4 packs of baby formula at one store after striking out at another. Svetlana Petrychuk, 56, said she was most worried that she would not be able to buy a certain brand of dog food for her Yorkshire Terrier, Lord. Ms. Petrychuk got Lord about 2.5 years ago after suffering a stroke in the aftermath of 3 nearby Russian drone strikes. Her doctor suggested that a dog might relieve stress. The shortages in warehouses and the fact that some food is currently missing from supermarket shelves worries me much less, Ms. Petrychuk said. We, as people, can easily make do with whatever food is available. Luckily for Lord, she found the dog food at the second store she checked. Grocery chains said they hope to fully restock their inventory by Monday, Ukraine's Independence Day, although Thursday's attacks may make that difficult. On social media, some Ukrainians joked about the return of the Soviet Union. Before its breakup in 1991, such shortages were common. Some older customers remember famines throughout Ukraine's history as if they happened yesterday and have stockpiled canned foods and staples like sugar, pasta, and flour. I could live for an entire month without buying anything except bread, said Ola Slyusarenko, 76, who made a practice of stockpiling well before the war. The Silpo supermarket chain has tried to address the shortages with Ukraine's typical stoicism and dark humor, blaming Russia while also telling people to just hold on. Orange and white signs display poems about the hardship, with blank spaces in each line where customers can write their own reactions. Russia, blank, probably blank, hoped this would be our end, blank, and bring only sorrow, but here we have anger, blank, new ideas, and blank, gratitude, blank, for our people, one sign said. Novos, another supermarket chain, posted a simpler sign near its empty shelf of milk in a store in Kyiv. This product has been destroyed from Russia, it said, not even granting that country a capital R. New packages are on the way. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump threat puts focus on Iran's trading partners. President Trump appeared to suggest that the United States would impose economic penalties on countries that do business with Iran, though he did not specify what actions he would take. By Leo Sands. President Trump has threatened tremendous economic consequences on any nation that does business with Iran, without offering details. The threat appeared to be his latest effort to isolate the country from the global economy and pressure its leadership into negotiating an end to the war. The United States has already imposed debilitating sanctions on Iran's economy and its leadership, and the Trump administration has previously sanctioned certain foreign businesses and organizations that trade with Tehran. Mr. Trump's vaguely worded social media post on Wednesday seemed to suggest that he could target nations that buy Iranian oil without naming any. The president has, on occasion, backed down from such threats. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi of Iran dismissed his latest warning, calling it a diversion from America's own crisis. If Mr. Trump follows through, these are some of the countries that could be most affected. China. China is Iran's largest trading partner and the primary consumer of its oil, according to recent analysis by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, a group funded by Congress to examine America's bilateral ties to China. For years, China has been practically alone in its willingness to defy Western sanctions on Iranian oil, buying up to as much as 90% of Tehran's oil exports. In recent months, however, Iran's ability to ship oil by sea has been all but cut off by a U.S. naval blockade. Last year, China estimated its bilateral trade with Iran to be worth nearly $10 billion, a figure that doesn't include oil. But from a Chinese perspective, that is a drop in the ocean compared to the size of its overall economy, said William Figueroa, an expert in Chinese-Iranian relations at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. The biggest advantage Beijing draws from that trade relationship is geopolitical, said Andrea Ghisoli, a political scientist who specializes in China at the University of Exeter in England. Dr. Ghisoli described the share of oil that China imports from Iran as marginal and said that it can easily be swapped out for other sources on the global market. In response to a question on Thursday about the possible effects of coercive U.S. economic measures, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Lin Jian, called for all parties to resolve their differences through diplomatic channels. Sanctions and pressure will not help solve the problem, he said. India. Iran was once India's most important energy supplier, but U.S. sanctions have pushed New Delhi to reduce ties, and the value of trade between the two countries has shrunk dramatically in recent years, according to official data from the Indian Embassy in Iran. The data estimates that in the 2025-26 financial year, total bilateral trade was $1.63 billion, down sharply from over $17 billion in 2018-19. In 2019, India stopped buying Iranian oil altogether under pressure from Mr. Trump. In the last financial year, Indian officials said the country mainly imported apples, pistachios, dates, and kiwis from Iran. But in April, after the U.S. Treasury issued a 60-day waiver authorizing countries like India to purchase Iranian oil to alleviate war-driven supply disruptions and soaring energy prices, crude from Iran officially returned to India for the first time in 7 years. United Arab Emirates, Iraq, Turkey, and Pakistan. These four Iranian trading partners also appear vulnerable to Mr. Trump's threat, said Esfandiar Batmanghelid, chief executive of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, a London-based think tank focused on Iran's economy. On Wednesday, the United Arab Emirates appeared to preempt the president's comments by announcing a halt to trade and financial transactions with Iran. According to data from the World Trade Organization, Iranian-Emirati trade was worth roughly $28 billion in 2024. The Emirati decision could affect the ability of Iranian importers to pay for goods, as a lot of those financial services are provided through the UAE, Mr. Batmanghelid said. Pakistan and Turkey have so far been relatively shielded from U.S. economic measures against Tehran, even as they have continued significant overland trade with Iran, Mr. Batmanghelid said. In 2022, the latest year for which the World Trade Organization data was available, Iran imported more than $11 billion worth of goods from Turkey, its third largest source of imports that year. For both Pakistan and Turkey, it is politically and geopolitically very important that both of these countries maintain a good relationship with Iran, Mr. Batmanghili said. And I think this is where the Trump administration is really going to struggle. Burcu Özelik, a researcher at the Royal United Services Institute Research Group in London, said Iraq was also vulnerable to U.S. economic pressure because of its continued trade with Iran. American sanctions have already targeted Iranian-linked groups in Iraq. But Mr. Özelik said that broader sanctions on Iran's trading partners would be far more complicated to impose, and that implementing them will be slow, uneven, and difficult to monitor. It was far from clear that greater pressure would produce the political behavior Trump is seeking. Five U.S. deportees restrained after resisting deportation to Liberia. The five men were part of the first group of deportees to be sent to the West African nation by the Trump administration. The Liberian government has not clarified their status. By Emmanuel Akinwotu, Helena Cooper, and Hamed Aliaziz. Five of the 20 U.S. deportees who arrived in Liberia on Thursday as part of a deportation deal with the Trump administration refused to deplane and had to be restrained for several minutes by American federal agents, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. The 20 deportees arrived at Roberts International Airport on Thursday afternoon in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, according to Liberia's foreign minister, Sarah Bisalo Nianti. American federal agents escorting the deportees forced the five resisting men off the plane, but eventually all five were returned to the aircraft, according to three people who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the operation. The Liberian government has not clarified the status of the five individuals. The State Department referred questions about the operation to the Department of Homeland Security, which did not respond to requests for comment. The deportees arrived in Liberia amid a growing backlash in Africa, with critics saying the Liberian government's deal with the Trump administration to accept 1,200 U.S. deportees is too large and too opaque. And the resistance among some of the deportees underscored how the Trump administration's efforts to expel migrants to countries where they have no ties has caused fear and uncertainty, rights groups say. The deal with Liberia in West Africa is one of the largest struck by the Trump administration so far for so-called third country deportations, in which U.S. deportees are not sent to their home countries. It is unclear if any of the deportees have criminal records in the United States, but the agreement has raised questions among Liberians about a lack of transparency. The issue for deportations is raising many concerns that can't be left unanswered, said Adama Dempster, a human rights lawyer and activist in Liberia. What conditions will they be held in, and how does Liberia benefit, he said. Liberians, we are hospitable people, we love strangers, but the government should explain this. The deportees will initially be held in a government facility and be allowed to seek asylum in Liberia or return to their home countries, said Jeralinmek Matthew Pia, Liberia's information minister. They are being received as guests, he said in a statement. He highlighted Liberia's history of welcoming refugees and migrants, often deported to countries where they have no ties, as an explanation for the deal. Liberia's government has said it did not demand or receive any compensation as part of the deportation deal with the Trump administration. Mr. Dempster said this was hard to believe, considering the economic challenges in a country where more than half of the 6 million people live in poverty. What is more concerning is that the U.S. is sending 1,200, a high number, he said. Liberia has a struggling economy where unemployment is high. What conditions will be put in place to help? 30 countries have made third country deportation deals with the Trump administration, according to Human Rights First, a nonprofit group that tracks deportations. The majority of the countries making such agreements have been in Africa, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ghana, and South Sudan. No information about the deportees' records has been made public, fueling anxiety in Liberia, where crime centered on the drug trade has exploded in recent years. A crackdown by law enforcement has seen hundreds of millions of dollars of cocaine seized by officials. Mr. Pia, the information minister, said the deportees were not criminals and not being prosecuted in any manner under United States or Liberian law. But his denials have been met with skepticism among rights groups that say his statement does not adequately address whether the deportees had criminal records or were awaiting trial. The deal with the Trump administration has also raised questions about whether diplomatic pressure was applied on Liberia, a country with deep ties to the United States. Liberian history is rooted in America's Back to Africa movement and the American Colonization Society, a group formed in 1816 by philanthropists, abolitionists, as well as some slave owners. English is the country's official language. Last year, Joseph Boakai, Liberia's president, was one of five African leaders to meet with President Trump at the White House. Liberia's economy and health system have been hit hard by cuts to American foreign aid, damaging perceptions of the United States and fueling suspicions that Liberia was forced to negotiate from a position of weakness. As a sovereign country, was it possible for President Joseph Boakai to have refused President Donald Trump's offer of accepting these individuals? Asked Clara Mala, a program officer at the Center for Transparency and Accountability in Liberia, a civil society group based in the capital. Why can't America keep them? Why Liberia? Ken Paxton and the curious case of the missing $1,000 pen. The pen Mr. Paxton pocketed more than a decade ago has resurfaced as a campaign issue. By Lauren McGaughey. Outside a Ken Paxton fundraiser in Washington, D.C. last month stood a mobile billboard truck highlighting the many legal and ethical scandals the Texas Attorney General has faced over the years. The list included a criminal indictment on securities fraud, impeachment in the Texas legislature, and a stolen pen. The pen was a pointed reference. The ad, paid for by supporters of Mr. Paxton's Democratic opponent for Senate, James Tallarico, harked back to an episode more than a decade ago when Mr. Paxton pocketed another lawyer's $1,000 pen while passing through security at a courthouse outside Dallas. In Texas politics, the Mont Blanc story has become an enduring piece of niche Paxton lore. But the episode remains unfamiliar to many Texas voters and even some potential Paxton donors. I don't know anything about it, Barry Kendrick, a pilot who lives in Texas, said as he stood near the billboard truck after leaving the fundraiser in Washington last month. That has not been for lack of Mr. Paxton's political opponents trying for years to turn the purloined pen into an effective line of attack. Security footage of the episode was used against Mr. Paxton, a Republican firebrand, during his run for re-election as Attorney General in 2018. This spring, Senator John Cornyn's supporters included the pen in an attack ad as he tried unsuccessfully to fend off Mr. Paxton in the Republican primary. Last week, it resurfaced in an ad for Mr. Tallarico, featuring an endorsement from Joe Joplin, the lawyer whose pen Mr. Paxton took all those years ago. Vote for James Tallarico, the voiceover in the ad states. He won't steal your pen. The events in question took place at the security checkpoint of a Collin County courthouse. Mr. Joplin had left his Mont Blanc pen in a security bin. Mr. Paxton spotted the pen, worth around $1,000, and took it as he passed through security soon after. Mr. Joplin returned to retrieve the pen, which was a gift from his wife. The building's security footage, dated August 14, 2012, captured the man who took it, Mr. Paxton, who was a state lawmaker at the time from the area. A sheriff's deputy reached out to ask Mr. Paxton if he had the pen. He said he did and agreed to return it. Madison Searcy, Mr. Paxton's campaign spokeswoman, called Mr. Tallarico's attempt to resurrect the incident a childish attack about an issue that had already been addressed. This was nothing more than a mix-up at security, she added. The line of attack involving the pen was familiar to Justin Nelson, the Democratic nominee for Attorney General in 2018, who used the security footage as part of his campaign. He still marveled at the episode. It's such a ridiculous set of circumstances, right? Mr. Nelson said in an interview. Even if it was some innocent mistake, the reality of it is he took somebody else's $1,000 pen. Mr. Paxton, then a well-funded incumbent, ignored the attacks during the 2018 campaign. This time may be different, Mr. Nelson said. Mr. Paxton has been trailing in fundraising and in some polls. The national attention surrounding Mr. Talrico has carried the pen further than it ever traveled, and the pen's owner has offered an endorsement for the first time. J.T. Ennis, Mr. Talrico's spokesman, said the incident revealed something about Mr. Paxton's character. He's the kind of guy who will steal your pen. The Talrico campaign has also been selling its own ballpoint pens for a $6 campaign contribution that read, "Not Ken Paxton's pen." Mr. Nelson's campaign tried the same thing in 2018, selling pens with the message, "Don't let Ken steal this pen." Mr. Paxton has long denied any wrongdoing in office. The indictment on securities fraud charges in 2015 resulted in a deal in which he paid restitution but did not admit guilt. The impeachment on corruption charges in 2023 ended in an acquittal. Mr. Kendrick, the pilot at the Washington fundraiser, said after seeing the stolen pen billboard, he watched the security footage and could not tell whether Mr. Paxton had mistakenly pocketed the pen or taken it on purpose. Mr. Kendrick was more surprised that anyone would own a $1,000 pen. "I got a laugh out of that," he said. It did not change his mostly positive opinion of Mr. Paxton, he said. Mr. Kendrick, who advocates for pilots, said he frequently attends meetings with officials of both parties where he has to go through a metal detector. To protect his belongings in the security bin, he carries a plastic bag with him. Into the bag goes his wallet, his watch, and yes, a Mont Blanc he said he bought at Costco a decade ago for about $100. That pen goes with him everywhere, he said, including to the Paxton fundraiser in Washington. And no, Mr. Kendrick joked, Mr. Paxton did not try to take it. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, August 21st issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.